the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Welcome to a Wednesday. It is the 25th of April. And speaking of freedom of the press, as we do in the intro to the program, the new rankings are out from Reporters Without Borders. It's an international group that does these freedom of the press rankings each year. And the United States has fallen two spots from number 43 to number 45. Yes, just behind Romania, South Korea, Taiwan, and Burkina Faso. Yeah, that's the good old U.S. of A. And they attribute it, Reporters Without Borders, to Donald Trump and his ridiculing of so-called fake news. And not to say that there's not fake news. We've been talking about the fake news for years. In fact, there's been a plethora of fake news.
Your original source for fake news. Fox News. We make shit up.
Ah, they've been doing it for longer than I have. Not been making it up, but been talking. Fox News has been making stuff up. But Donald Trump, in his trolling ways, in his gaslighting ways, has been talking about the real media as those who make shit up. And the outlets that make shit up is the real stuff. It's the gaslighting of America. It's the trolling of America, which is a interesting time for this new Freedom of the Press Index to come out, because today on the program we're going to speak with Amanda Marcotte. You've read her stuff in Salon and elsewhere over the years. She's got a new book out called Troll Nation: How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Fucking Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. She doesn't mince any words. It's a good book. Usually when I have an author on, I get to, you know, I can read a couple of chapters is about all I get to before the interview comes up. I actually read the entire book this weekend. It's easy to read and makes a lot of sense. So we'll be speaking with her later. But I had a rough night last night. Those of you who've listened for a long time know that I suffer from restless leg syndrome. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning, my legs woke me up, and I was up for at least a couple of hours just in misery. What happens is you just can't sit still. Your legs, it feels like, the best analogy is like there's ants crawling inside of your legs, and so you can't hold your legs still. And the best way to deal with it is to get up and walk around. So I had a pretty sleepless night. So this morning I was lying in bed and I watched Emmanuel Macron's address to a joint session of Congress. And even he picked up on the fake news.
To protect our democracies, we have to fight against the ever-growing virus of fake news, which exposes our people to irrational fear and imaginary risks.
The audience liked the fake news comment. The question is, which fake news was he talking about?
And let me attribute the fair copyright for this expression, fake news, especially here.
I think he was talking about the real fake news, the Fox Newses, the crap that Breitbart pushes on you, the stuff that these right-wing outlets push as if they're real, the made-up shit, as opposed to the real news that Trump decries as fake. It is opposite world. Yes, it is. But one thing after watching Macron, I was impressed. Now, Macron is no liberal progressive. He's just not. Although compared to Donald Trump, he's Bernie Sanders. Seriously. And after watching the speech today, I was just very, very much taken with him. I think he's trolling Trump in the biggest way. After 2 days of the flirting and the kissing and the hand holding and the sucking up, I think Macron understands the way to get through to Trump is by flattery. You flatter the man. There were a few points in today's speech. I'm going to play some of it for you. Macron's English is actually quite good. He does have a thick accent. You know, he's the president of France. But his English is very good. So if you listen, you can understand him. First thing, I'm going to play one clip for you in which he denounces nationalism. He's basically saying this America First nonsense is just flat out bullshit.
Let me say we have two possible ways ahead. We can choose isolationism, withdrawal, and nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
This is an option. It can be tempting to us as a temporary remedy to our fears. But closing the door to the world will not stop the evolution of the world. It will not douse but inflame the fears of our citizens. We have to keep our eyes wide open to the new risks right in front of us. I'm convinced that if we decide to open our eyes wider, we will be stronger. We will overcome the dangers. We will not let the rampaging work of extreme nationalism shake a world full of hopes for greater prosperity. It is a critical moment. If we do not act with urgency as a global community, I am convinced that the international institutions, including the United Nations and NATO, will no longer be able to exercise a mandate and stabilizing influence.
Mm-hmm.
We would then inevitably and severely undermine the liberal order we built after World War II. Other powers with a stronger strategy and ambition will then fill the void we would leave empty. Other powers will not hesitate one second to advocate their own model to shape the 21st century world order. Personally, if you ask me, I do not share the fascination for new strong powers, the abandonment of freedom, and the illusion of nationalism.
Ooh. He's going right up against Trump there, who loves the strong man. Right? Who just idolizes people like Duterte and Erdogan and those kind of powers. I think that was a direct slap in the face to Trump. He also went after him on the JCPOA or the Iran nuclear deal. I'm not going to play that clip because it's rather lengthy and we got stuff to get to. But he went, you know, no question went against Trump on that and said that, let me see if I can just get the end of this. I'm gonna play the last 30 seconds or so of this clip.
Without having something substantial and more substantial instead. That's my position.
Well, okay. What he said was, we can't abandon the Iran nuclear deal without having something more substantial there instead. It was pretty strong rhetoric, basically saying Trump is wrong to say that he will leave. But where he was strongest was in challenging him on the Paris Climate Accord.
What is the meaning of our life? Really?
Really?
If we work and live destroying the planet while sacrificing the future of our children, what is the meaning of our life if our decision, our conscious decision, is to reduce the opportunities for our children or grandchildren?
Good question. The opportunities for our children and grandchildren. That was that word.
By polluting the oceans, not mitigating CO2 emissions, and destroying our biodiversity, we are killing our planet.
Mm-hmm.
Let us face it. There is no planet B.
There is no planet B. That was the president of France saying that. Let's face it, there is no planet B. Sounds like he's from 350.org.
On this issue, it may happen we have disagreements between the United States and France. It may happen.
It may happen.
Like in old families.
Ah.
But that's, for me, a short-term disagreement. On the long run, we will have to face the same realities, and we're just citizens of the same planet. So we will have to face it. So beyond some short-term disagreements, we have to work together with business leaders and local communities. Let us work together in order to make our planet great again and create new jobs and new opportunities while safeguarding our Earth.
The Democrats were on their feet. The Republicans, not so much. I don't know if Scott Pruitt was there or not.
And I'm sure one day the United States will come back and join the Paris Agreement. And I'm sure,
as soon as we get rid of Dump and elect a Democratic president, we'll rejoin the Paris Agreement.
And I'm sure we can work together to fulfill with you the ambitions of the Global Compact on the environment.
Let's hope so. Again, it's not going to happen with this president. And I was so pleasantly surprised to hear Macron come out so strongly against Trump on so many different fronts. It was a really good speech. So I didn't catch up on sleep, but... Yeah, VT Blom in the chat room says, imagine that, a leader who speaks eloquently and makes sense. Again, Macron is no liberal progressive. He's not. He's the equivalent of what Republicans used to be in this country. I think I heard Tom Hartman say he's to the right of Eisenhower. Eisenhower today would be considered, you know, a moderate Democrat, you know. Put him next to Trump, and he was groundbreaking and wonderful. And then to make matters even better, to elevate him even further, in my view, today he went to the Martin Luther King Memorial with John Lewis. Yes, Macron did. So last night was the big state dinner. There were no congressional Democrats invited. Apparently, there were three or four Democrats total invited, probably the whole room, including John Bel Edwards, the governor of Louisiana. I think he was the only elected official who was a Democrat who was invited. But I think Macron really just trolled Trump really well this entire trip, made him think that he doing the flattering thing and playing the game just shows he's a good politician, is what it shows. All right, let's get to what's news, shall we? As we tend to do on days there's a lot of news, we'll do it live.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Admiral Ronnie Johnson was supposed to be on Capitol Hill for his confirmation hearings today. That was before allegations surfaced that show he is unfit to serve as head of the Veterans Administration. John Tester, the ranking member of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, speaking on NPR yesterday.
Well, they fall in three different areas. Improper dispensing of prescription drugs. Repeatedly drunk while on duty, while traveling, and creating a toxic work environment. He is the physician for the president, and in the previous administration, we were told the stories where he was repeatedly drunk while on duty, where his main job was to take care of the most powerful man in the world. That's not acceptable. We didn't initiate this discussion. This discussion came when we were notified by folks that work with Admiral Jackson, folks in the military, about behaviors that had happened.
John Tester had more to say to Anderson Cooper last night on CNN.
These are called controlled substances for a reason. We have...
So he would actually just go down the aisle and
yes,
just sort of say
on the plane.
Who wants to go to sleep, who
on
wants
the
to
airplane.
Wake up.
That's the reports we got from the people, the 20-some people who got a hold of us and said, we've got a problem, this doctor has a problem, because he hands out prescriptions like candy. In fact, in the White House, they call him the candy man.
Ooh. So I just want to be clear, Ambien is actually one of the drugs?
I can get you the, okay. It's a drug, it's a prescription drug, and I can get you the name.
Your staff had told us Ambien
right.
and
yep.
Provigil.
Bingo.
Okay.
Those are the ones.
All
yeah.
right. And I understand he had a nickname in the White House of the White House staff.
And it was the candy man because he handed out prescription drugs like they were candy.
The White House doctor, his nickname among some people in the White House was the candy man.
That's correct. That's what we were told.
That's not a nickname you want in a doctor.
That's not a nickname you want the doctor, and if you consider the prescription drugs we have a problem with in this country right now, it's not the example we need to have set.
Tester told CNN that his committee had spoken with 20 former and current members of the military about Jackson, and the allegations included concerns about his use of alcohol while on the job. And think about it. What job can you drink on? They talked about excessive drinking on the job. He's the White House doctor, and he's drinking? And the only jobs I can think of where you can drink on the job is Mad Men, right? If you're back in the 50s and you're in the advertising age, 50s and 60s. During yesterday's question and answer session with French President Emmanuel Macron that passes for a press conference in the Trump era, Trump was asked about Ronnie Jackson and the allegations against him. Trump gave him cover to pull out.
I said to Dr. Jackson, what do you need it for? So, we'll see what happens. I don't want to put a man through who's not a political person.
Then why'd you nominate him?
I don't want to put a man through a process like this. It's too ugly and too disgusting. So we'll see what happens. He'll make a decision.
So are you saying, Mr. President, that you will stand behind him?
I would definitely stand behind him. He's a fine man. I'll always stand behind him. I'd let it be his choice. I wouldn't. If I were him, actually, in many ways, I'd love to be him. But the fact is, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. What does he need it for? I really don't think personally he should do it, but it's totally his. I would stand behind him, totally his decision.
By the way, in today's White House briefing session, Sarah Sanders was asked what kind of vetting was done, and there was nothing other than the routine vetting done for the White House doctor. There was no additional vetting done, although she didn't come out and say it in so many words, for him to be appointed or nominated to be head of the VA. Just saying. Ronnie Jackson, however, appears to be wanting to continue on.
Dr. Jackson, can you say anything at all about these allegations that have come out against you in the last few days?
No, I'll just say that I was looking forward to the hearing tomorrow, kind of disappointed that it's been postponed, but I'm looking forward to getting a reschedule and answering everybody's questions.
You've seen the allegations, a hostile work environment, the allegations about potentially drinking on the job, over-prescribing medications. Are you saying those are categorically untrue?
I'm saying I'm looking forward to the hearing so we can sit down and I can explain everything to everyone and answer all the senator's questions.
Was there an IG report about the allegations?
No, there was not.
How about much for heading to the White House to be before you were formally announced as the nominee.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Sir, you're definitely not withdrawing. You're going to continue this process, sir.
And with that, he ducked into a senator's office. Trump did meet with Jackson in the Oval Office yesterday afternoon. Jackson said he's not going anywhere, and Trump continues to stand by him. Unbelievable. President yesterday said that during that Q&A session, said that the North, or actually it was before the Q&A session, it was while sitting in the cabinet room with French President Macron, that North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, the man he once mocked as Little Rocket Man, has been very open and very honorable.
As far as North Korea is concerned, we are going to be having a meeting with Kim Jong-un, and that will be very soon. We have been told directly that they would like to have the meeting as soon as possible, and we think that's a great thing for the world. That's a great thing for North Korea and South Korea and Japan.
Unreal.
And France and everybody. So we're having very, very good discussions. Kim Jong-un really has been very open. And I think very honorable from everything we're seeing. Now, a lot of promises have been made by North Korea over the years, but they've never been in this position. We have been very, very tough on maximum pressure. We have been very tough on, as you know, trade. We've been very, very tough at the border. Sanctions have been the toughest we've ever imposed on any country. And we think it'll be a great thing for North Korea, and it'll be a great thing for the world. So we'll see where that all goes. Maybe it'll be wonderful, and maybe it won't. And if it's not going to be fair and reasonable and good, I will, unlike past administrations, I will leave the table. But I think we have a chance of doing something
very special. Past administrations haven't been at the table.
With respect to North Korea, good for them, good for us, good for everybody.
When he was asked to explain those comments at the Q&A later in the day, he sidestepped the question, as did Sarah Sanders today in the White House briefing session. In the special election in Arizona's 8th District that took place yesterday to replace Trent Franks, Republican Debbie Lesko won, defeating Democrat Hiral Tipernini. The big story, though, was that the margin was only 6%. It was 53-47 in a district that Trump won by 21% of the vote. A federal judge last night ordered the government to continue DACA and accept new applicants. U.S. District Judge John D. Bates called the decision to end the DACA program virtually unexplained and therefore unlawful. However, he stayed his ruling for 90 days to allow the Trump administration to provide a more solid reason for ending the program. The Supreme Court saved one of its biggest cases for last. The justices heard arguments this morning over Trump's ban on travelers from several mostly Muslim countries. It is the last case the justices will hear until they reconvene in October. The Trump administration is asking the court to reverse lower court rulings striking down the ban. The policy has been fully in effect since December, but this is the first time the justices are considering whether it violates immigration law or the Constitution. The court will consider whether the president can indefinitely keep people out of the country based on nationality. It'll also look at whether the policy is aimed at excluding Muslims from the United States. And breaking news, just in the last hour or so, the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson is proposing tripling the amount the poorest households are expected to pay for rent. This is unreal. The move to overhaul how low-income rental subsidies are calculated would affect more than 4.5 million families relying on federal housing assistance. The proposal, the legislation, would require congressional approval. Let's hope nothing happens before November and that the Democrats take back the House. Because tax cuts for the wealthy, but make the poorest among us pay triple what they pay now. I think the minimum payment is $50 a month. So those people who are so poor that that's what they pay for their subsidized housing, they'd be raised to $150 a month. Unreal. All right. We've got Amanda Marcotte coming up to talk about her new book, Troll Nation. First, let's check in with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I think. We're having problems. Uh-oh. All right. Let's see. We'll do this.
The super rich are quietly assaulting our democratic rights. Hear about the Koch coup on America today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. The Koch brothers believe that their great wealth entitles them to rule over the many. So, for decades, they've been running a surreptitious assault on the rules that protect the majority of us from their abuse. From whacking our voting rights to busting unions, their plutocratic intent is nothing less than to pull a coup on democracy, installing a government of, by, and for the super rich. They've enlisted a secretive cadre of other billionaires who share their extreme kleptocratic belief that, one, property rights of the rich are more important than the people's political rights, two, that majority rule is not a good form of governing, and three, that the makers, as the billionaires dub themselves, should be able to overrule collective actions of the lower classes, whom they call takers. They've created a complex, sophisticated web of right-wing front groups that have already corporatized a slew of our most basic laws and institutions. And they've gained a chokehold on nearly every level of government, including our courts and whole states like Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Texas. To carry out their attacks, they've essentially taken over the Republican Party. Even more shocking than the arrogance of this unprecedented power grab by the conspiracy of billionaires is its quiet success. The Koch coup crept up on us because it abhorred publicity and couched each move as an independent effort by a separate group. Then, the conspirators backed the Supreme Court's outrageous 2010 Citizens United decision, decreeing that unlimited corporate spending is allowed because it's, quote, free speech. Only then did Americans begin waking up to the reality that the Kochs were making an assault on democracy itself. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more, check out the extensive Koch web files at the Center for Media and Democracy at exposedbycmd.org/Koch.
Mr. Hart has no clients that has business before this agency.
Contrary to denials, lobbyists tied to EPA chief's condo did lobby the agency.
So, yes, I'm going to send them a check for the monies that America had promised.
Former New York Mayor Bloomberg donates $4.5 million to help U.S. keep Paris Climate Accord promise. Court reinstates fines for automakers that violate fuel economy standards, plus...
Using natural thermometers such as measurements of tree rings and ice cores, man says he has been able to calculate ancient temperatures to a fraction of a degree.
The 20th anniversary of the famous hockey stick graph.
All of those anniversaries and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
But one thing is certain, the heat is on. Global temperatures for the first 3 months of 1998 were the warmest on record.
Are we still playing that record? Yep. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, EPA Chief Scott Pruitt leading our Green News Report. Yet again today?
Oh, yes, he is. New revelations suggest that Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt was less than forthright when defending his below-market rental deal from the wife of an energy lobbyist in Washington, D.C. In an interview with Fox News in early April, Pruitt claimed that renting from a lobbyist was not at all a conflict of interest.
Why does it matter when the ethics officials look at the lease and the terms of the lease to determine whether it's ethical
or not?
Why
does it matter? It's because you're renting it from the wife of a lobbyist.
Yeah. Who has no business before this agency.
Hold on a second.
Mr. Hart has no clients that has business before this agency.
Turns out that's not true.
What?
The lobbyist in question, J. Stephen Hart, resigned from his lobbying firm on Friday after new lobbying disclosures showed that Hart did indeed lobby the EPA while Pruitt was leading it and was actually present in at least one meeting with Pruitt in an official capacity.
So the lobbyist had to quit for doing his job. The EPA chief, he has yet to quit, even though he's wildly corrupt.
Right. Hart denied that the meetings met the definition of lobbyist, but said he was retiring earlier than previously planned. A small but growing handful of congressional Republicans have joined congressional Democrats in calling for Pruitt to resign.
They can call all they want. Apparently, he's not answering the call.
A win for consumers and the environment. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on Monday in favor of environmental groups by rejecting a Trump Department of Transportation attempt to delay fines levied on car manufacturers who violate federal fuel economy standards for cars and trucks. The fines had finally been updated to account for decades of inflation. In the meantime, the department has announced it plans to repeal those fines altogether. Meanwhile, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said he has volunteered to pay $4.5 million to cover a portion of the U.S. commitment to a United Nations fund to help developing countries deal with the impacts of global warming. That was part of the Paris Climate Agreement. The U.S. had pledged $3 billion to the United Nations Green Climate Fund, but President Donald Trump reneged on that deal when he announced his decision to withdraw from the accord. In an interview with CBS News, Bloomberg said he feels a sense of responsibility.
America made a commitment, and as an American, if the government's not going to do it, we all have responsibility. I'm able to do it. So, yes, I'm going to send them a check for the monies that America had promised to the organization as though they got it from the federal government.
Well, he's going to send them $4.5 million of the $3 billion that we had promised, but we appreciate the effort.
Indeed. Finally, this past weekend marked the 20th anniversary of the publication of the famous hockey stick graph by climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann and his colleagues in the journal Nature. Mann's study used tree rings and ice core data to reconstruct past climate temperatures and showed that the planet's temperature had been relatively stable for 500 years and then, in the 20th century, dramatically and suddenly spiked upward like a hockey stick. Here he is in a 1998 CBS News report.
We believe we are seeing the effect of human beings on the climate of the 20th century.
The graph's publication in 1998 also marked the launch of an unprecedented attack campaign funded by the fossil fuel industry that attempted to discredit Dr. Mann and all climate scientists in order to confuse and mislead the public about the dangers of global warming. Since the release of the hockey stick graph, the science of man-made climate change has only gotten stronger, as have the real-world impacts. And now the oil industry is beginning to face mounting climate liability lawsuits.
And they continue to face Michael Mann, who continues to push back. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. No, I'll stand my ground. Won't be turned around.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back, and I'm really excited to speak with our next guest. I hope Amanda Marcotte is on the line. Are you there, Amanda?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, thank you so much. Amanda Marcotte is a senior political writer for Salon, who previously spent a decade as a freelance journalist, so you've read her everywhere. Her new book, released just yesterday, is called Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Fucking Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Is this your first one?
No, I wrote a couple books many years ago, but I guess I decided to get back in the game, the book writing business, because of the Trump election.
Well, there's a lot there. I got to tell you, usually when I have a guest on the show, because I do so many, you know, I do four shows a week, I generally get a couple of chapters in, I get a taste of the book, and then I move on to the next one. But I read the whole thing this weekend. It's a really good book, and it's just eminently readable. So I highly recommend it. Plus, we've been living through this, so everything, it's like, yeah, that's exactly what's going on.
Well, that's good to hear. That makes me happy. Yeah, and in writing it, I think, kind of felt like that. If anything, the only thing I was too worried about was feeling that things were going to be out of date between, you know, filing my manuscript and it being published, because the news cycle moves so fast these days.
That it does. I don't know. I'm sure you get the same feeling I do, that there's so much. There's one thing, out of all the lies Trump has told, there's one little montage I have that rings true.
The heads would spin.
Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
Your head will spin.
My head is constantly spinning because you get through one day and there's so much going on. It's like, okay, I don't even know where to begin. And then the next day happens and it happens all over again. Things that on in a normal world would be big news sometimes barely get mentioned because there's so much stuff going on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we would be foolish to believe that that isn't by design. I mean, I don't know that Trump is some kind of great mastermind, but he is a chaos. He thrives on chaos. He clearly thrives on chaos. It's not just the way he runs his administration or even the way he ran his campaign. You know, you look at the man's entire life, and all he ever did was seek drama, seek conflict. I mean, he's been involved in how many, like over 1,000 lawsuits? Mm-hmm. Think about that.
It's insane. Well, the book is called Troll Nation. Now, if one spends any amount of time on Twitter, you get the notion of a troll nation. What do you mean by the term troll nation?
Well, you know, I really wanted to explore the idea that online trolling, as we know it, has kind of consumed the entire American right, which isn't to say that all American conservatives are trolls, online trolls. But the sort of mentality that drives trolling, this sort of meanness and sadism and desire to punish other people for no real reason other than just to be mean, I think has become the sort of central organizing force of the American right. And I don't mean like the Republican Party necessarily, though I think they pander to it, but like, you know, actual movement conservatism is mostly focused these days on hating liberals and trying to punish them and get revenge. And I conclude that the election of Donald Trump was really kind of the ultimate example of that, because the only point of voting for Trump, the only point of nominating him to be the Republican candidate, is that he is uniquely aggravating to liberals and has a unique capacity to just really destroy everything in his path. You know, the rest of the Republican candidates weren't great, but they weren't trolls as much as he is.
Right.
And so I think that's really kind of what I'm arguing in this book.
You seem to trace the roots of Troll Nation back to Gamergate. Can you explain for those who, I remember it, but it wasn't something, I thought when it was going on that it really was dealing with, it was online video games, something that is not part of my world. So I honestly didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, but it was kind of the precursor of this whole Trump world, according to your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Troll Nation has a lot of parents, but I like Gamergate because it was a very specific, you know, precursor to what happened. And what it was, you know, video gaming as a culture has been changing in recent years. A lot more women and people of color have started to play, but also become journalists and programmers and people with power in the community. And a few years ago, what happened was there was this sudden, complete, like, outrage, like, almost like online riot from a bunch of young white men and, you know, some of their sympathizers who didn't like these changes. They didn't like seeing feminism in video gaming. They didn't like seeing people talking about racial diversity in games or criticizing games for being, you know, politically incorrect or whatever. And they start flipping out on people. And it was on Twitter and Facebook and just online. They started organizing these mass harassment campaigns, mostly aimed at female video game programmers and journalists who they deemed, you know, too feminist and should be basically drummed out of video gaming. And it was a particularly ridiculous thing because it was just video games, but I think it really kind of showed that there was a lot of anger out there from white men that feel like they deserve to be dominant and do not like having that challenged. And, you know, what I explained in the book is that a number of conservative publications, namely Breitbart, with Milo Yiannopoulos, saw Gamergate and realized that this was about more than video games, that these angry young men who were just mad about feminists and video games could be made angry about feminists everywhere. And they went and they actively recruited the Gamergaters to become what I think we can now say is the alt-right.
Wow. So there is a direct correlation there, that type of activity led to the alt-right, which in itself is a whole trolling brigade of people. They're out there to harass liberals. If there's one thing all these people have in common, it's their goal of getting to the liberals, getting under our skin.
Yeah, and I think, you know, particularly with the alt-right, but I think this is kind of spread throughout the right generally, you have a lot of situations where they deliberately create these opportunities to troll liberals, and then when liberals react to them negatively, they then play the victim, right? And they use that as a way to garner sympathy, garner attention, and recruit more people to their side. And again, Milo Yiannopoulos is particularly good at this, but there's many others. Ben Shapiro has been getting involved in this. You know, going to college campuses, giving a speech, inevitably attracting protesters, and then saying, look at these terrible protesters, they oppress me, and using that as a way to get attention for your views without actually having to talk about what your views actually are.
Right. Well, it goes to political correctness. You have got two chapters on political correctness. And you know, they twist things around. I was thrilled that you mentioned gaslighting, because I don't think the whole concept of gaslighting gets enough attention, which is, that's what this is all about. The Trump administration is constantly gaslighting us from, you know, I liken it to them telling us the sky is green when we know it's blue, but they're constantly saying it's green, and we're made to feel crazy because we insist that the sky is blue. There's this gaslighting of America going on. You know, it's happening with the whole fake news nonsense. There's plenty of fake news out there coming from Fox and Breitbart and these sites that Trump uses, and it says that's the real news when the actual real news he says is fake.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one thing to think about is that this explains why Trump will say one thing one minute and then completely flip it and reverse it and say something else the next, and he doesn't have any consistency at all in his public views. And I think ultimately that's because it doesn't matter to him. He doesn't believe in anything except winning. And he actually, I think, gets a kick out of, you know, saying he's for DACA one minute, being against DACA the next minute, being basically there unable to pin down, because being changeable like that, being all over the place like that, is very effective at trolling liberals. It's very effective at driving people nuts, and that's his only real goal there, because when we're just chasing our tails, you know, he's accumulating more wealth and more power.
Right. You're right. I want to talk about political correctness for a moment, because you mentioned Milo Yiannopoulos and the whole idea of them going to a college campus to have a speech and, you know, call it free speech week. When, again, it goes back to gaslighting. It's not free speech. It's their right to troll people. That's what they want, but they are calling it free speech, I think, as a way of gaslighting America.
Yeah, so I think the thing to think about when, you know, you see these kind of campus stunts is nobody ever writes about what the content of the speech was that is so controversial, right? Christina Hoff Sommers, Milo Yiannopoulos, Ben Shapiro, they'll all go to a campus, and there will be all this fur, and there'll be protests, and there'll be demands that they're deplatformed and all this, and what never actually is talked about is what the speech was about. Even the people that come to see the speech don't care what the speech is about, because it's not about that. It's about creating that circus atmosphere. It's about creating this sense of victimization and really plugging into this conservative notion that they are somehow victims of something. and using that to sort of create a sense of tribalism and grievance, all without actually having to engage a debate about ideas, their actual ideas.
Media plays.
They would lose.
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
Yes. No. That's no. You're absolutely right. And it's almost that the speech itself is secondary to the act of being on the campus, which is a liberal bastion.
Yeah. Exactly. Their followers know this. This is why they're often more interested in standing out around outside the event and tussling with the liberal protesters than they are actually going in and being bored by sitting there and actually having to listen to this stupid speech.
Right. You recount the story of the one, and I forget where it was, maybe at Berkeley, where they had the whole, ostensibly the free speech week, which they never even, they didn't even go through the motions of organizing. They didn't get the permits. They didn't do all the thing. It was just the idea of doing something to, I guess, get the left riled up. And when it came down to it, it was one, you know, 20-minute, not even a real event that took place.
Yeah, I found that interesting. And when I tried to get Milo to answer some questions about it, he just called me a name and wouldn't talk to me. But it was interesting because UC Berkeley had been criticized from the right for supposedly censoring conservative speakers. So this time they told Yiannopoulos, you know, come to campus, have your free speech week, do whatever you want. And then what they found out was the long list of speakers that he supposedly had coming, he didn't actually invite them. The room that they were trying to rent, they never bothered to actually put the money up for it. And when the school said, we're kind of starting to feel this event wasn't real, Yiannopoulos went to his Facebook page and did this very well-made, clearly pre-made video claiming he was being censored. So, I mean, I don't know for sure what was going on, but it looks awfully like they deliberately created a situation where the event wasn't going to happen so that they could claim they were being censored when they weren't.
It's amazing. It's all gaslighting. I had the opportunity to interview Roger Stone once, and he denied that he knew what gaslighting was. Again, another form of gaslighting. We're speaking with Amanda Marcotte. The book is Troll Nation: How the Right Became Trump Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat Fucking Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. And congratulations for putting rat fucking in the title of the book. People in the chat room are loving that.
All my editor.
The media did play a big role in the rise of Troll Nation. Would the election of Trump have been possible if not for Fox News?
I don't think so, not at all. I mean, for one thing, Fox News, while Trump was able to get on ABC News and Good Morning America and other shows to push his birther conspiracy theory, like, you know, Fox News was really the people that gave him that platform and gave him an opportunity to present himself as a political figure. I think it's worth remembering he's run for president twice before and nobody cared.
That's amazing. But he never went, I mean, he never took it as far as he did this time.
No, and in part because, you know, he's, I think, you know, a fundamentally kind of lazy person. And even this time, I think he was only just doing it for branding purposes. But because he had been on Fox so often pushing this birther conspiracy theory, he actually had an audience and he actually had some momentum behind him. I think, you know, I think he was probably even surprised by it, because it's worth remembering that the 2016 Trump campaign was not a very real campaign when it started off. Like, it was a PR stunt at Trump Tower.
Yep.
His campaign staff was like three people.
Right.
It wasn't a serious effort, and there is something of that play the producers to his campaign.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't meant to succeed, and then it did.
To everyone's surprise, including his own, I think that's part of the problem. I still think to this day that he had never had any intention of being elected, never thought it would be possible, and was as surprised as the rest of us when on election night he was declared the winner.
Yeah, and I'm sure by the time he actually got the nomination, he was, like, in it to win it, or at least a little bit more, but he started that campaign as a troll, and he was only trolling people to get attention and hopefully make some money, I think. That's my theory.
Everything's about money. Well, everything's about money with him. So, you know, if there's going to be an ulterior motive, that's going to be it. Throughout the book, you sprinkle case studies spotlighting people from Neil Gorsuch to Sarah Palin. Now, some might say, I do, that Sarah Palin opened the floodgates of Troll Nation. You hint at that as well. Was she the original impetus for this, of, you know, that Trump was possible?
I think so. I mean, the sort of mentality that fueled Troll Nation has been around longer than her, for sure. I mean, I really think a lot of it goes back to Rush Limbaugh more than anybody. And I was reminded today of the 2004 Republican convention when people were running around wearing Purple Heart Band-Aids
right.
to imply that John Kerry's Purple Hearts weren't real. So this predates her, but she was the first politician who played that game of, like, on that national level, who played the game of tribal politics, grievance politics, you know. Everything she was doing was not about making an argument for her vision, but about being provocative and trying to annoy liberals. And her fans loved her for it. The rest of the country, I mean, I think panicked, and John McCain, you know, was probably going to lose anyway, but that definitely made him lose. It's interesting to me that in the 8 years after her candidacy, though, the way that she campaigned ended up becoming the very thing that helped Donald Trump get nominated.
It is wild. Because if you listen to him speak, all I can think of is Sarah Palin half the time, the way he rambles on in the word salad he uses. You know, working with audio, when I try to edit an answer of his, it's impossible because he's all over the place and he just reminds me of Sarah Palin.
Yeah, and both of them are what's funny about that is, what drives you and me nuts about them is, I think, exactly what is appealing to them, to the conservative base, which is they are substance-free. There's nothing there. They, you know, Sarah Palin doesn't, I don't think she could name one government program if you asked her. And Donald Trump certainly can't. He has strong opinions about DACA, but gets confused about what it is, for instance.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter because all they're doing is they're throwing out provocations in this sort of, like you said, word salad. And the whole point of it is to signal white nationalist identity politics and to irritate liberals.
But in irritating liberals, that's the gist of it. The identity politics. You have a chapter on women. Trump motivated women, I think, too late, after the fact. I mean, seeing the Women's March the day after inauguration was kind of inspiring, but there was this pit in my stomach that made me say, where were all you people, you know, on Election Day? Tell us about your chapter on women, how women relate to Troll Nation.
Well, I think, you know, what it really comes down to for me is that there's a lot of cultural resentment right now about the rise of feminism in our culture and changing gender roles. And I think for most of the past few decades, the conservative argument against feminism has been to lean on this notion of traditional family values. They tried to make this positive argument, right? That women's place is in the home because everybody's happier that way, that women should be chaste and domestic because it's good for the family, right? And what's happened is that argument has lost the cultural, like, it's just, I don't think it has the kind of traction it used to have. I don't think people believe it anymore, even on the right. I think, you know, women increasingly reject those arguments, even if they identify as conservative themselves, at least for themselves, right? And so what's been left with all those justifications and rationalizations taken away, what's left is just this kind of inchoate rage at women. And so we've gone from, you know, the old traditional Republican arguments about abstinence only and abortion is bad and traditional family values and all these things to electing this guy who says he grabs him by the pussy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the base loves that guy because they don't really care. It just exposes that it was never really about traditional family values. It was always just about putting women in their place. And while Donald Trump has been married 3 times and clearly only embraces anti-abortion politics because it's politically convenient, he does hate women.
Yes.
And he very sincerely hates women. And so his base loves that because, and I think ultimately what I'm arguing is that it really shows that the mask is off, that they don't really care anymore to make positive arguments for themselves or their values. It's just about anger and nihilism at this point.
Right. You don't really deal with the evangelicals, the religious right, as it were, which to me is the biggest conundrum out there. It just, you know, shows them to be the hypocrites that they are, because his approval rating among evangelicals is through the roof.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, I thought about that some, but what I think this last election has really proven is that the notion that white evangelicals are a category of people motivated by religious faith has basically been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. It was never true, and what has happened is that we've now seen that white evangelicals are just white nationalist identity politics, that it's all about Christianity was never about faith in Jesus. It was always about creating a justification for viewing themselves as a tribe that deserves to dominate everybody else. And that's true, you know, of European fascism as well. It's not like a lot of people that really pray a lot and go to church and care about Jesus, but they use the church as a shield for what are fundamentally their racial politics.
Right. And how sad is that? And part of me thinks, and this is where we get into, you know, crazy territory, that, you know, maybe he is the Antichrist they've been hoping for to bring about the end of the world.
You know, the arguments that actual evangelicals make to defend their support for Donald Trump occasionally veer into that territory.
Uh-huh.
But usually they try to make it sound a little more positive than that. they say he's King David.
Oh, okay.
But it is true that they kind of can't deny that he's a massive sinner. I've noticed they don't even really try to deny that he slept with Stormy Daniels. They just instead openly say, well, he's our sledgehammer, you know?
Yes. We give him a mulligan. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't care what he does as long as he destroys the right people.
Right. And raises the rent on the poorest among us. The final chapter of the book, Troll Nation, asks, will there be an end to Troll Nation? You're not very optimistic, are you?
No. I really wish I could say that I am, but I cannot see how to fix this problem, and especially not with the tools that liberals have. I mean, persuasion doesn't work. Reason doesn't work. Asking nicely doesn't work. You know, we have no emotional leverage. We certainly can't reason with them. So as far as conservatives that have decided to commit to this very nihilistic worldview, they've done that for their own reasons, and I don't know that there's anything that we can do to talk them out of it. That said, I do conclude, I think that, you know, there's hope. It's just not in rational discourse. There's hope in organizing the left and just trying to win, you know, the old-fashioned political way with our numbers, and we do outnumber them.
Right. And if we could get everyone to the polls, there's a chance, you know, November is not too many months away. If the Democrats can at least take back the House, there's a glimmer of hope there.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it.
You and me both. Amanda Marcotte, the book is called Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Fucking Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. It is, as I said, it's a great read. And I shy away from most things Trump because it hurts my stomach. But I really enjoyed the book. Thank you so much, Amanda. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Tomorrow on the program, it is Thursday. That means Howie Klein Day. So lots to talk about, including the election in Arizona, which although the Democrat didn't win, it was a win. And with that, I'll leave you for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you tomorrow.